Health and Human Services Committee for the Senate on Friday, March 23rd. I apologize for getting started a little bit late. This is kind of a unusual day. We've got the Finance Committee meeting at the same time, and there are a number of members of this committee that are also on the Finance Committee, and some of the bills that we're hearing are brought by members of the Finance Committee, including Senator Bonhoff's bill. So we are going to take 2304 first. We are waiting for the amended version of 1402 that was done in Judiciary, so we need to get a copy of that. So, Senator Bonhoff, we'll start with your bill, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to start by just speaking briefly about the Sunset Commission, because this is something new this year for the first time, and want to make sure that the members understand what the purpose was and the process for which I'm bringing this bill forward. So last session, we passed a law that said every single agency, commission, council would be under review on a cyclical basis to determine whether or not they would be sunset. And in fact, if the legislature took no action, that those commissions, agencies, councils that were under review for sunset would actually abolish. So we took that as a pretty high stakes mission, knowing that if we didn't come to some agreement on the Sunset Commission, that the result would be these agencies, councils, and commissions would go away. Another interesting thing to note is the council was equal membership, or the commission, excuse me, Republicans and Democrats. We had four governor appointees, as well as two members of the legislature, myself and Mike Nelson on the DFL side, and then the other GOP members were made up from the House and the Senate. Mary Kiffmeyer was the chair. I was the vice chair. I will tell you that this commission spent approximately 60 hours reviewing testimony and looking at all of these boards and commissions. It went very well. I would say it was a highly effective process, and the bill before you today is the result of a consensus report that the commission came together and presents within the confines of this bill. So particularly, I'm here before you with regard to the health licensing boards. That we spend a great deal of time reviewing the health licensing boards. And after we had originally reviewed them, unfortunately, it was brought to our attention that by the Star Tribune that there was an investigation taking place at the same time, saying that the health licensing boards were not transparent, that there were some things that were happening where they felt as though doctors who had persistent malpractice issues were not, that information wasn't getting to the public. And so we then got the commission back together and asked very pointed questions. And so some of the recommendations that we do have before you in this bill are a result of that inquiry. So, Mr. Chair, would you like me to go specifically to the health licensing boards rather than take you through the other parts of the bill?
Senator Bonhoff, I think, yes, there are some of these things covered in the bill that really are not in the jurisdiction of this committee, so I think it would be preferable to focus on just the areas that are under this committee's jurisdiction, which would be the health licensing boards.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you start on Section 13 of the bill, Section 12 of the bill refers to the health-related licensing board's website, and there we list very clearly things that we feel it's in the public's best interest to have on that website. There is not consensus between the health licensing boards and what's in this bill yet. And the reason for that is because we have included in this bill putting information with regard to malpractice judgments and settlements. That's problematic in that, as we have heard from the doctors themselves, that oftentimes a malpractice case is settled by the insurance company. It isn't always a case where there is, so to speak, guilt to be found. And so we are working closely with this group to craft language that both sides can live with, that gives the public more information that they currently have, that creates an accurate picture of a doctor's record without putting something that could inadvertently damage the reputation. And so, Mr. Chair, it's a little bit unusual that I'm telling you that while this is in the bill today, Representative Kiffmeyer has taken the lead on that particular section, and she's guaranteed us that it's going to be all fixed before she gets to her Health and Human Services Committee. And I said, well, that doesn't help me very much. So if, for example, Mr. Chair, if you didn't want to just trust that we were going to work that out and you were concerned, I would be open to striking the word settlement, because that is one of the most egregious things that we've heard from in terms of settlements don't always indicate whether or not something was good or bad. So that's something I'm offering. I'm not telling you that we have to do it that way, because I really, after working very closely with Representative Kiffmeyer every step of the way in this process, I am confident that we will come to agreement on the language, and it's going to actually be broader than just striking one word. You'll see that, I'm sorry, also, Mr. Chair, you'll see that we have added the submitting a full set of fingerprints to the board. That was something that, because of the technology being available, seems as though many groups are doing that. I understand, after talking to Senator Limmer, that they're actually recommending that we take a time out on fingerprints and come back next year and establish a protocol and a process for how fingerprints are going to be used going forward. In addition, there's a couple more things that are important to understand. We are insisting that there be a programmatic review of the Medical Health Licensing Board. And so in order to make that happen, there are two options. We're suggesting that either the Office of Legislative Auditor do that in consultation with the National Board, or if the Office of Legislative Auditor is not directed by our own legislative LAC, if they do not direct the OLA to do that, you know, because we all get to say what we rate who we want the OLA to study, then, in fact, the Medical Licensing Board is very comfortable to go ahead and contract with the National Board to do that programmatic audit. We think it's very important given the kinds of concerns that have been raised this past year. The fee for that audit would come out of their own license fees.
Senator Bonhoff, there is an amendment here. Is that something that you were offering? Okay, the council is telling me this is a technical amendment, although...
Could I see a copy of that, please?
Sure. And I'm thinking that perhaps we could incorporate into this amendment your comments about, on page 6, the striking of the word settlement in section 12 that might... at least call attention to that compared to whatever the House language might be.
Mr. Chair, I am happy to do that.
Does this go to another committee after this as well?
Mr. Chair, this goes to Judiciary.
Judiciary, okay. Do you have a copy of the amendment? You're looking at it?
Mr. Chair, and this is just technical cleanup of the language.
Thank you.
Just seeing anything in there that you're concerned about.
Looks okay. Thank you.
What I think I'll ask Senator Benson would want to move that amendment and incorporate into it on page 6 of the bill, in section 12, down on line 6.28, strike settlement or, and then on 6.29, strike settlements, and on 6.30, the word and. And I think then that just refers to judgments. Is that?
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Okay. So Senator Benson moves the A6 technical amendment with the oral additions that were suggested by Senator Bonhoff to the 2304. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Are there other things? I guess, Senator Bonhoff, there is a Section 9 that talks about disclosure. Looks like that section makes some minor changes to corrective action and the enactment date.
And Mr. Chair, the other thing that I didn't mention is we're also requiring a study of the actual Medical Practice Act.
Right.
So that we make sure that the act itself allows for the kind of transparency that we're looking for.
Okay.
And takes into account the need for data privacy. It's interesting, we had a woman speak in our previous committee who had gotten a substantial settlement through malpractice, and she had come to find out that the doctor who had caused the problem for her had several other instances where this was the case, and yet she was opposing that the settlements be in the bill because she did not want her privacy in any way breached. And so on the one hand, she wished she could have had that information about that doctor, but on the other hand, she didn't want anything about her to be public. And so it is really important that we craft this in a way that does both, protects the public but also protects privacy.
Okay. Are there any witnesses that want to comment on the bill?
Oh, there she is. Mr. Chair, I didn't realize she was here again
right.
today.
My testimony the other evening.
Could you please identify yourself?
My name is Susan Zawaska. And I'm here just as a citizen. I'm not here representing any physician group, any organization. But I will tell you that my testimony the other night at that previous committee had absolutely nothing to do with the concerns for my privacy. And I did not wish that any other verdicts or settlements would have been on the website. I'm not sure, Senator Bonhoff, where you came up with that, but my testimony was almost exactly opposite.
Well,
and I see that also there was some laughing with regard to my testimony, some smiles in exchange. I'm not finding that particularly funny. I am a private citizen, and I am very private. And to come here and testify is probably about my own private life, is probably one of the most difficult things I've done in my life. And to see that exchange was heartbreaking and disappointing.
And Ms. Washka, I apologize. I'm sure that no one was intending to put you in an awkward position. I guess I'm a little confused about exactly what is the issue that you're raising.
Well, let me tell you my story and what my opinions and thoughts are with regard to this. I was the subject of the February 5th Star Tribune article, Doctors Who Err Escape Penalties. It was my story that the Star and Tribune used among to start off their report and to talk about other issues that they found during their investigation. It was this article that created this firestorm of opinions, comments, articles, and now legislation regarding the Board of Medical Practice. In 2007, I was injured during a routine procedure done by my physician. The follow-up care involved another 13 procedures over the span of 2 years. Needless to say, I went through The physician took responsibility for his error at the time of the injury, and he reported it to his malpractice carrier. Not only did he do that, but he also wrote in his medical record and talked to me about the fact that he committed this error, did this error, and that he was reporting it to his malpractice carrier. I went to the malpractice carrier, and I asked them to pay for my medical bills. The response I got back from that malpractice carrier was an explanation of the elements of a medical malpractice lawsuit and that I needed an expert to prove negligence. Eventually, I filed a lawsuit, which was a very difficult thing for me to do, knowing now that my belief or my want for privacy was no longer. However, I did not feel that my health care insurance company or I should be responsible for my mounting medical bills. During the course of the litigation process, I asked the malpractice carrier if they would be willing to mediate the case, because I did not believe this case belonged in trial. The day before the mediation, the malpractice carrier informed me that their only offer would be zero. Mediation was, of course, canceled. The case eventually went to trial in February 2010. The verdict was $1 million. I can assure you that I was stunned by the verdict amount, considering that this case should have been settled long before and could have saved the malpractice carrier hundreds and thousands of dollars, not to mention the cost of litigation. On July 26th, 5 months after that verdict, I filed a complaint to the Board of Medical Practice. While the care I received was certainly substandard, I was not intending at all to file a complaint. It was my case. It was one incident. And I also knew that the Board of Medical Practice received verdicts and settlements, and that they, and that I trusted that they would review this case among any other information they may have and determine for themselves whether or not this physician was a harm to others. However, during the course of litigation, and particularly after the verdict, I received numerous calls from patients and the patients' representatives about experiences with the same physician. I even received a call from the physician's own staff member regarding concerns safety of patients. I learned that there were two particular cases in which the physician did a procedure that caused a massive infection, leading two patients. One had to be hospitalized to undergo several other procedures and left with very harmful scars. In another case, during a procedure, they had to be stopped because the patient was in such significant pain she could not continue with the procedure. She eventually went to another physician and had the procedure completed, but was forced to have many other procedures as a result of the original physician's work. I was provided with deposition transcripts with the physician's sworn testimony from several cases that he was involved in, with alarming patterns of care similar to what I had experienced. I was told of other complaints previously made to the board by patients, other physicians, and even members of his own staff regarding poor care he was providing. I am a private person, as I stated, and all I really wanted to do was simply move on in my life. However, I felt obligated to speak on behalf of these patients because there was a recognizable pattern of care that was concerning. After reviewing all of the information I was provided, I believe that the physician's ability to provide his patients with quality and safe care is non-existent. A 6-page letter directed to Robert Leach, the executive director of the Board of Medical Practice, I articulated concerns about this physician's practice. Supporting my letter were medical records, deposition testimony, complaints and other stories of other patients. Most of all, I used the physician's own testimony from previous cases to support my thought that there was a pattern of poor care. There were patterns of substandard prescribing practices. In my own case, the physician had prescribed me so much medication that there was an interaction causing serious side effects. He also provided me with a prescription from another patient in which he tore the label off of the medication bottle and told me to take it. There was poor documentation in patients' medical records, missing medical records, and failing to create a medical record. In my own case, when I went to seek care from other providers, they could not put my case together. They could not see what medications I was prescribed, what caused the interactions, why was I having the side effects, what was I treated with at the physician's office, how was he managing my injuries at the time. It was non-existent. And this was the same with all of these cases that I reviewed. Allowing non-medical employees was another thing that he did, dispense narcotics in his office. Allowing non-medical employees to make medical decisions on his behalf. That was a particular issue in my case, and after reviewing these cases of others, I found it to be in most cases as well. But most importantly, there was a consistent pattern or outcomes in which patients were severely injured. It has been nearly 2 years since I filed my complaint, and I have heard nothing from the board, even though I inquired about the status. Consider this. The time that it took my entire malpractice case to be litigated to a conclusion, service of the complaint, discovery process, the trial, the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court was done in less time than it has taken the board to do anything with regard to my complaint. And I'm not here to gain sympathy from any of you. I don't need that. My purpose of being here is twofold. One, to express my support for the appropriate action that would assure that the board is protecting citizens from unsafe medical care. I have read the legislation, and I understand there is a proposal to do an audit. But if that audit isn't done by an outside party that has no biases, that audit will have no meaning. I'm also here to oppose the publicly reporting of malpractice verdicts and settlements. While I know that transparency is important, I have been surprised at how the issue of transparency has taken on a life of its own in the situation, overshadowing, perhaps ignoring, the real issue that was published in the Star Tribune. Transparency is easy. It's an easy fix. For the average citizen, it's easy to understand. But what does posting settlements and verdicts on a website do about the real issue? And that is whether or not the board is appropriately reviewing complaints and addressing them in not only a timely fashion, but in a fashion that takes seriously physicians who are at risk to the public. In my case, for example, there would be a $1 million verdict posted on the physician's website. What does that tell the average consumer of health care? How do you explain a $1 million verdict that should never have gone to trial? While I can't tell you what went on behind the scenes, I have little doubt that the physician in my case did not want to go to trial, considering that he admitted his negligence. I can tell you that putting the verdict on a web page will provide no service to the public. Will someone look at that verdict and simply say the facts don't pertain to me? Or it's not the procedure I'm looking for, so there should be no problem? You are giving the citizens of Minnesota a false sense of security because simply posting a case on the website does not tell anyone about the physician's ability to provide quality of care to his patients. Or will someone look at the verdict and decide they're not going to go to that physician? I can honestly sit here today and tell you the physician in my case does not deserve to be judged by the public based on a verdict or a settlement. Some of the most competent, well-respected physicians we have here in Minnesota have had malpractice claims. And in fact, cited in the Star Tribune article, 40% of physicians undergo a malpractice claim during their career. Think about the disservice that you are doing to the public by posting verdicts and settlements on a web page that could lead to a person not seeing the patient or not seeing the physician who is perhaps the most qualified for that particular condition. Again, how do you explain medical malpractice verdicts and settlements without confusing or misleading the public? Serves no other purpose than unduly harming the reputation of physicians. You can't throw that kind of information at the public and expect them, the average citizen, to understand what it means to them. Malpractice cases are some of the most complicated cases in the tort system. The facts of the case are complicated, and medicine is even more complicated. Medicine is science. And in science, there are always variables. And in medicine, the largest variable is the human being. People are injured. There are poor outcomes, and lawsuits do occur. Once a lawsuit occurs, I have no doubt the physician loses control over his or her own destiny. The insurance company and the lawyers are the drivers of the malpractice case, and it is common knowledge that settlements and cases that go to trial are often without the physician in agreement. But the physician has little choice about how that case should be handled. Asking the public to make a judgment based on a complicated malpractice case is unconscionable. The public should trust that the totality of a physician's practice is being evaluated by those who have the experience to determine appropriate standards of care. What is a quality, safe practice of medicine? And this morning, Senator Bonhoeff said that she wants to take out settlements out of this case. That would, in my case, have done no good because all of the previous cases had been settled. So really, if right now, if you look at his the case, there would be one verdict on them. Settlements, I can tell you, were much more than what my case was. I also know that the most egregious cases of medicine are settled out of court. There is no lawyer or no insurance company that wants to take a case that they can't win to trial. I suppose except for in my case. There is no evidence to support the conclusion that malpractice claims are indicators of a physician's ability to provide quality of care to his or her patients. Quality is the purview of the Board of Medical Practice, those highly trained individuals whose mission and obligation it is to protect the citizens of Minnesota. The public should choose their physician based on trust, skills, expertise, and the quality of care that they receive. They simply would not get this from verdicts or settlements. I know I certainly relied on the experts at the board to evaluate the quality of care the physician, in my case, provided me. I was not competent to determine the standard of care for dermatologists practicing medicine in the state of Minnesota. I trusted that the board, with all of their resources and all of their years of experience, could do a much better job than me in determining what is quality, what is concerning patterns of care that need to be addressed. It is the expertise of the board that you, as state representatives, should also rely upon, as opposed to asking the public to review the board's medical malpractice website and determine on their own whether or not that physician is a good physician. Finally, don't punish the majority of excellent physicians that we have here in the state of Minnesota by putting such misleading and prejudicial information on a website that has no meaning. Instead, look to the Board of Medical Practice, their beliefs, their processes, and their practices. Would you feel comfortable having you or a member of your family go to see a doctor that has the same practice that my physician had, that has the same patterns of poor care, that has harmed patients in the past. It could have, because you would have no clue. And I want to ask yourself, I want you to ask yourself, are you okay with that?
Thank you, Ms. Washka. I would like to get some clarification. With respect to the bill and the portions of the language that are in the purview of this committee, what are you recommending? Are you recommending that there be nothing, no website with information posted with respect to legal actions or judgments or settlements?
No.
that we should not do that at all? Or what exactly is the issue that you're raising with the bill?
I thought I was clear, and I'm sorry if I wasn't, but I do not believe that verdicts and settlements should be on the website.
And so
with regard to the other information that's in the bill, I have no issue with that.
So your point is rather than just not post settlements, as was suggested, but also not post any judgments either. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
I can't imagine why taking settlements out of this issue would be of value. So you're only going to post verdicts, which is already meaningless to the public, but to take settlements out. And I know the most egregious cases of medical malpractice are settled. Once again, misleading the public.
What are you also raising issue with the Board of Medical Practice? Are you raising the question that you don't believe that they're capable of disciplining themselves? Is that sort of the point that you're trying to make?
Well, I guess I'm not sure what they're capable of because I have yet to see any results in my case. I do wonder about they have to punish themselves, but I also have a belief that physicians need to be involved because they're the experts in evaluating these cases.
The section in the proposed bill that deals with the Board of Medical Practice review that talks about having the legislative auditor perform an audit, is that, are you raising issue with that as not being effective?
I can't raise an issue with that because I don't know enough about the auditor of the or the federal. But all I can tell you is that whoever audits the boards, either Minnesota or anyone else, should be something totally removed from that situation.
Well, the legislative auditor is a body that works under the jurisdiction of the legislature and does many things. It's not directly tied to the Board of Medical Practice or any other institution other than the legislature itself, I guess.
And that's the state auditor?
Yes.
No, it's this legislative auditor is an office that is created by and responsible to the state legislature, and they do perform audits, and they also perform work at the direction of the legislature. There is a commission that directs the legislative auditor to do certain things. It's different than the state auditor, which is a different position, an elected position, independent of the legislature.
I understand that, but I think, Senator Bonhoff, you mentioned something about a federal.
Mr. Chair.
No, Senator Bonhoff.
And I guess I would just first like to apologize if you did feel that day that you testified that your comments were in any way, that there was any indication that we didn't take your testimony quite seriously, because, in fact, you were quite moving to me. And so if, in my paraphrasing, I only reflected a piece of it, I apologize, because I was left quite concerned, and actually I was left after your testimony more certain than ever that we had to do this review, that there has been enough questions raised about whether or not the Health Licensing Board is protecting the public, that we must do this review. And so I have actually followed up with Jim Nobles and said that if it ends up that the OLA does this review, I've asked him to do it in concert with the federal board, because I have gotten some certainty, and I have spoken to a member of that board that they do this all the time. That is in their scope and responsibility. They understand what to look for. They understand signals that show things aren't being done with regard to protecting patients, and that is our first priority with this bill. So with regard to putting anything on the web, as I mentioned earlier, it's a little bit tricky because we agree that putting settlements and judgments in itself does not tell the whole story and can be misleading, and so we are working to expand that language so that it reflects a fuller body of action than just something like that. And we are not going to let this go forward this year without that expanded language. But again, it's being worked on. It wasn't ready for this committee. So that's why I suggested that we just strike that word so that you have an indication we understand that doesn't tell the whole picture. One other thing that I thought of was to just strike that section and then come back in a conference committee report. But that didn't seem also to be the appropriate thing because then, you know, I think that the fact that this doctor had so many other problems that you do need to be able to reflect that on the web. Should the licensing board have let that go on? No. They should have actually, you know, I think had him not be practicing on patients at that point. But at least there should be a secondary check so that there's, if you see all of a sudden that there's a pattern of cases being brought forward, I think the public should see that. So that's...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
With what you're proposing is to take settlements off, the public wouldn't see anything. They would see my verdict. And regardless about this physician, my point is, what about the 95% of the other physicians who practice on a daily basis excellent care, who get involved in a malpractice case? It happens all the time. Why should they be punished by putting such information on a website? And I also want to say, yesterday I talked to a reporter from the Star Tribune, who told me that she absolutely wants the information on the website because she's a reporter and she could use that. Well, that completely takes out the purpose of what you're trying to accomplish here.
And Mr. Chair, one other piece of information. Sir, we are actually, before we present the final language, we are studying what other states have in their medical practice reviews and actually have found a couple states that does a very thorough job. And so that's why I'm not here presenting the exact language, because we had already reviewed the medical practice board, and they did not share with us that they were undergoing this evaluation and that the story was coming forward. And so we spoke pretty pointedly to them, saying that we didn't appreciate having them come before sunset review and not even understanding that there were these kinds of issues. And so ever since then, we have actually, you know, even though we're in legislative session, we've delved deeply into this issue, and I can assure you that it's being taken quite seriously.
Senator Bonoff and Ms. Washka, as I understand this, what Senator Bonoff is indicating is that issue that you're raising is one that they are aware of and that there is not agreement on how to deal with the issue of disclosure and what ought to be disclosed and how that should be handled, recognizing the points that you're making. I think all of us appreciate that you're not going to get a clear understanding of a physician based on whatever settlements or judgments may be entered against that particular physician. One of the reasons to strike the words that Senator Bonhoeff raised is to make this bill different than the bill in the House, which would then require additional work be done on this section before it was enacted into law, since the bills have to be the same. Now, if it may be that section 2 under, or that paragraph 2 under section 12, the entire paragraph ought to be removed, if that really is the focus of where the work needs to be done. I don't think that anyone, I'm not hearing anybody, and certainly not Senator Bonhoeff, disagreeing with your point that these things don't reflect the entirety of what is what's acceptable or not from the standpoint of the public's awareness of how good a physician may or may not be. There's certainly more to it than that. So I'm certainly open to doing more things to change the bill to make sure that this area gets the appropriate focus. We have another witness. Do we want to hear from Mr. Dick before we proceed? Mr. Dick.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Eric Dick, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association. The MMA represents nearly 10,000 physicians, medical students, and residents from all specialties and all practice areas. Thank you for the opportunity to join you, and thank you, Senator Bonhoff. You've been generous with your time, and we've had a number of conversations and continue to do so, and we're grateful for her willingness to listen. Thank you in particular to Senator Bonhoff and members for striking the settlements. That was one of our concerns and actually serves to strike much of my testimony, for which I'm also grateful. The MMA believes the number one role of the Board of Medical Practice and all health licensing boards is to protect the public. They do this by ensuring a minimum standard of training and expertise by those applying to practice medicine and by disciplining those who practice substandard care. The MMA supports the intent of Senate File 2304 as it relates to protecting the public. Some provisions may serve to protect the public, while others may not. We support providing information to consumers that will be helpful to them in recognizing unprofessional, incompetent, or unlawful practice. However, we caution you from requiring all data from being publicly released, particularly when that data is not a good measure of a physician's competency. There's a balance between the use of helpful information with information that may not present a complete picture and may, in fact, be misleading. The MMA can support the posting of criminal convictions of gross misdemeanors and felonies, unlawful actions. The MMA also supports the reporting of actions taken by other state licensing boards. We agree that this information should be available to consumers. I might suggest, given that we've taken care of the settlements issue, there's one additional change we might recommend, and that is page 7, line 1. This section deals with posting of other state actions. As I shared earlier, we support the posting of actions taken by other state licensing boards. However, the current language is much broader than that and will include actions taken for which we cannot assure necessary due process. This language includes privilege restrictions taken by other healthcare providers. For example, this could include a hospital restricting privileges for economic or anti-competitive reasons. In today's large corporate healthcare systems, it is not unusual for some physicians to be denied privileges because of utilization reasons, referral patterns, or other reasons unrelated to competency. This is information that does not help a consumer decide competency or quality. As in any state or with any profession, there are a small number of physicians who require scrutiny and action by the BMP. The MMA fully supports this role. Yet the public is not served by posting additional information, particularly the privileging information, again, because it does not paint a complete picture. We hope to continue to work with Senator Bonhoff and the committee and the legislature to pass a good bill that provides meaningful, helpful information to consumers while not causing confusion with information that will not be helpful and may, in fact, hurt both the patient and the physician. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Bonhoff, for your time.
Mr. Dick, just maybe you could make a comment about the issues that Ms. Washka raises. What would be the appropriate way to, or appropriate information that ought to be made available to the public so that someone in her circumstance would have known perhaps beforehand that this particular physician may not have been the right one for her to deal with? What is the answer to that question?
I can't pretend, of course, to speak for Ms. Zawaska or other consumers. I think that her point, again, at the risk of putting words in her mouth, is suggesting that the BMP is where these decisions should be made, that it's the BMP who has the expertise to make decisions about the complete nature of a case, given the complexities involved in these sorts of matters. Again, there are certain elements that are posted on the website now. There are additional things that would be posted under this proposal. Some of those items might not paint that complete picture. I believe the board is maybe where those decisions can best be made.
I have one point, Senator Hahn.
Ms. Washka.
First of all, just because other states are doing it does not make it necessarily right. And also, if a physician, such as the one in my case, has so many settlements and now a verdict against him, I know the average consumer needs to know about that. They should know about that through the board's work. What should be on the website should be something from the board about how they handled this physician's particular quality care. that's not there.
Okay. Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Dr. Dick?
Mr. Dick.
Mr. Dick?
I'm pretty far removed from a physician.
Okay. I didn't catch it. Sorry. I'm listening to the testimony of Ms. Zawaska, and I'm trying to kind of put it in place where she is, where her problem lies with this bill. And maybe this will help me understand what she's talking about. How do you communicate with patients when they make a complaint to you about a physician? I'm a nurse, and so I've worked, and 99.9% of all the doctors I work with are wonderful people and would never harm a fly if they could help it. So if I got her testimony, it was the non-response. There was no follow-up. Is there a way that you communicate with patients?
Mr. Dick?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hoffman, that's probably a question best asked of the Board of Medical Practice, how they communicate with patients, how they communicate with complainants. I'm not sure if that's one that I can answer.
Okay.
All right.
I can't tell you,
Ms. Washka.
Senator Hoffman, that the physician received a letter from the board about a week before the February 5th article came out. They're fully aware of who I am. I was the one that made the complaint, and I've heard nothing.
Okay.
And I should hear something. In fact, I believe that's in the Medical Practice Act, that they should let the complainant know. And I had requested a status of that. I've heard nothing.
Senator Bonhoeff, with respect to the bill, the Board of Medical Practice review, is it your thought that the language in the bill would address some of the concerns being raised here to make sure that there are appropriate responses and so forth? Is that part of the intent of this review?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's exactly why we put this in. And we have gotten a commitment from the Health Licensing Board that they have the resources available. They actually want this to happen. They seem to want their name cleared, and I don't understand why they haven't communicated back.
Are there other questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm willing to make an oral amendment in response to Mr. Dick's testimony to strike on line 7.1 or restriction of privileges.
Page 7, line 1, or restriction of privileges.
I'll move that.
Senator Laurie moves the oral amendment on 7.1. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay.
Mr. Chair, just one Senator more Bonner. Thing that, and I'm looking in the bill and I'm not finding where it actually stated, but we were concerned, as we heard from all the health licensing boards, about the investigations that occur. The way the process works is when a complaint is filed, an investigation is opened. And those investigations are done through the Attorney General's office. And so we actually studied how long those investigations were taking, and we're concerned in some cases that there seemed to be investigations that were taking too long, and that, or, you know, that I actually was quite, I was left with this thought that there was something wrong in our process. So we met with the Attorney General, and we suggested that perhaps the administrative services unit, which serves all of the boards, could take a stronger lead in doing those investigations. We didn't come to an agreement, but we did put in the bill that they had to report back to us on a new process by which the Attorney General's office would work with the administrative services unit on investigations. Let's see, Mr. Hubinger.
Section 15, I'm
thank you,
getting
Section
advised.
15. Because, Mr. Chair, again, these were things that came out where you could see there's a breakdown in process.
Okay. All right. Are there other questions on the bill? And, Senator Bonhoeff, your understanding is this bill has to be moved to Judiciary Committee, is it?
Yes.
Judiciary.
Yes.
Or it's got to go to both the Jobs and the Judiciary Committee. Is that true?
they're nodding. Yes, I had not heard Jobs, so.
The combative sports.
Oh, combative sports. Gotcha.
You have a preference? Which one you want to go to first? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, I've been in communication with Senator Limmer pretty closely, so he's expecting it next.
All right,
next.
Let's I would certainly entertain a motion from committee members.
Mr. Chair, I so move.
We do want to talk about the appropriation, and there is a section 21.
20.
20.
9.24.
Thank you.
9.24. $45,000 from the state government special revenue fund is appropriated. Does that fund have those dollars?
Sorry, section?
Section 20, line 24, 9.24 on page 9.
Mr. Chair, yes. They do have those funds, and I have confirmed that with them, that they have the resources to take care of that. I don't know if somebody is here right now from them, but I met with them with regard to that.
Okay.
It comes from their health licensing fees.
All right. So the board has that. Okay. Senator Rosen, you are willing to move the bill?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I so move.
All right. Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 2304, as amended, be passed and referred to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. Appreciate your work on the bill.
Thank you very much.
We are now members going to hear from Senator Wolf, Senate File 1402. And this is a bill that has some controversy attendant to it. However, in the jurisdiction of our committee, I don't believe that we really want to get into the testimony about the policy that is being brought here. I think that is under the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee, and I believe it has been heard there.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
And so really what we're here to look at is the effect of this policy were to pass on the MFIP program is what I understand. And so I do want to get some clarification on that and allow members to understand what this does. But you have an amendment or the and members should have a, I guess, a first engrossment that is slightly different, smaller from the original bill. This is what came out of Judiciary. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I haven't seen it yet, but the A5 amendment was the amendment that came out of, it was a delete all that came out of Judiciary on Wednesday.
Do you want to briefly explain what we have in front of us here, and then we'll take any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Can I get a copy of what's what it should be is the changes that were made had to do with changing the percentage on the first page.
It's on the second page now. On the second page.
I think it's on the second page of the...
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I said I hadn't seen this copy. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2, line 10, the percentage has changed from 25% to 35%. Then in section 2, a third tier was added to the... parenting expense structure, and then in section 3 deals with the effective dates.
All right. And there is, members, a fiscal note that is attached to that. It looks like it's over $100,000 in the fiscal year 13. Mr. Albrecht, did you want to comment on the fiscal note at all?
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Hahn, or the chair, has pointed out that it's about $115,000 impact. That impact is in the MFIT program. And if you go to page 8 of the fiscal note, under the assumptions heading, the third paragraph down describes the reasons for the financial impact on the MFIT program. And then on the next page, on page 9, those descriptions there in bold kind of explain the total impact for the various parts of the bill that have an effect on the MFIT program.
Okay. So further questions on the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, you noted that it has $115,000 impact in 2013, but it does grow significantly to the point where in 2015 it's $563,000. It looks to me like in Section 3, because there's this no modification of existing parenting time orders is put off in its effective date till 2014, at which time, I mean, as I read it, and these were just handed out to us, it looks like in 2014 all of these existing orders could come back in for modification, and the parenting the adjustment percentage would triple for the offset for parenting time. And I think that putting off the effective date and pushing the costs out into the out years and calling it $115,000 impact is needs to be pointed out. And then I guess aside from that, I would also like to know if this fiscal note was available when the bill was heard in Judiciary, because I know that's not our jurisdiction here, but it has a sizable fiscal impact in the courts. And so if this wasn't available when it was in Judiciary, I would hope they would want to see it as well. So I guess a couple of questions there, points to consider.
Senator Wolf.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, we had a fiscal note. It was not this one. We had a different one entirely on Wednesday that we were going from, and this is actually, I had not seen this until probably about a half an hour ago. So there was a fiscal note that was looked at on Wednesday, and the thought was at that time, because there had been no mention of the human services part in that fiscal note, that it was going to be going to finance, and then was determined sometime yesterday that it would need to come here first.
And Senator Wolf, the question Senator Lurie is raising about the cost to the court, was that essentially the same cost that was talked about in the Judiciary Committee as well?
Mr. Chair, I am sorry I do not have the previous fiscal note with me to compare it, but I've received three different fiscal notes and they're all different. So,
okay. All right.
And
Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, and again, you know, that same postponing of the effective dates to 2014 for all these modifications. If you look at the court's fiscal note, it goes from $18,000 in fiscal year 13, $36,000 in fiscal 14. It jumps to $1.5 in 15. That's because, you know, I mean, all of these child support orders are going to, you know, come, and the offset is going to be tripled, and every one of these cases is going to come flooding back into the courts. And that is not the proposal that was we had the as introduced language. That is not what the proposal was as this was introduced. So I mean, I can tell you the Judiciary Committee did not see this impact from what I'm seeing here. I mean, I and pushing it out to 2015, it doesn't sit well with me.
Senator Hayden.
So just as a qualifying, so Senator Lurie pointed out the pushing out the date. Can you tell us, Senator Wolf, why you decided to change that in the bill from this amendment to what was heard in Judiciary?
Senator Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I understand.
Well, it looks like the changing of the bill created a significant impact in the cost. So I'm just trying to figure out what was the rationale in bringing the first engrossment, or what is essentially a new bill or elements of a new bill from what was heard in Judiciary.
Sir Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The original bill actually carried a higher fiscal note from what the amendment was. The A5 amendment, which is the delete all, which is what you have before you now. So I guess I'm still not following exactly. So, I don't know if you want to.
Well,
better or not,
Senator Hayden.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess, I mean, since I didn't see the other fiscal note, it's not available, and I'm trying to follow I was trying to figure out if the reason why we did that is to create a lower cost in the first couple of years, and then we see that it spikes when folks can come in to get a modification. Was that the reason that we created this delete all, this first engrossment, so that it fit? The costs were lower in the first couple of years of the biennium, and then as we went forward, it looks like the modifications will come. Then it looks like the cost will spike, not only in terms of the cost to the court, in terms of the staff and extra cases that they'll have to hear, as well as presuming that we do modify these cases. Because the issue is, Mr. Chair and Senator Wolf, is every dollar in an NFIP case, that every dollar child support that is not going into the family, there is a presumption that those dollars will be replaced by the NFIP dollars. And that's why the spike in the cost. So, I mean, we're all just kind of presuming that this is what's going to happen. So I'm just trying to figure out, is the changing of the bill based on it fit, it drew down the cost to make the bill more palatable now, even though when we look out to the future, we're still facing this kind of child support tsunami, if you will, because of the change in the law?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try my best to answer that. We actually looked at another option as well with the effective dates, hoping that would have brought it down even lower. And instead, we got another fiscal back that was even higher. So of the fiscal notes part of it, the engrossment you see now had the best, had the lowest, I should say, fiscal note attached to it.
So, Mr. Chair.
Sir Hayden.
Senator Wolf, so maybe another way of asking this is, so if this bill goes into law, how do we deal with the loss of income, the potential loss of income in the family unit? So I think that's what the fiscal note is telling us, is that there's going to be loss of income in the family. So this looks a lot more like a child support bill than it does a family law bill or a presumption of custody bill. So I'm just trying to reconcile the fiscal note and what the presumptions are with the fiscal note to the issues of the income that children need to be able to live. That's where I'm trying to go, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wolf.
Mr. Chair, again, I'll try my best. Again, I have not had time to read through this since I just got it this morning. But again, making the presumptions as well that we're going to have this massive flood into the courts, you know, we're going on projections on how many parents we think are going to be going back to the courts getting this adjustment to happen. And that, you know, in 2015, there'll just be this massive flood and everybody will rush to the courts to make that happen. As far as the type of bill, like you said, we did change the bill considerably from the original version and increased the parenting time only by 10% and then added a third tier. And I guess I would argue as far as the costs, you know, and this is just from my personal opinion, I don't know if Molly, this is, do you want to handle this? What do you want me to keep going? As far as the costs, I'm not fully probably understanding the question. I would say some of the costs are going to be taken up by the parent who is increasing the parenting time. If they're with the child more, they're going to be taking on some more of that responsibility. So the cost would be shared by the parent who is increasing their parenting time as well.
So, Mr. Chair, and I'll just finish. I know others have to want to get in on this. I do note on line 1.19, it says a parent's failure to pay support because of a parent's inability to do so shall not be sufficient case for denial of parenting time. And so I guess as I start to read the bill, and I just got it as well, just trying to figure out that if we, and I know that that may even be in current law, but the idea that that often in these cases, I guess what I'm looking at is why are we kind of taking child support and this issue of custody and then kind of putting them together and changing that? And why would we not really kind of leave the support aspect of that alone and then really deal with this issue of?
Mr. Chair, we did have a mention in committee on Wednesday night the potential of raising the parenting time up to 45% and not touching the child support. So
No, the intent was not dealing with the child or making any mass problems with the child support, but increasing, making more equitable the parenting time. And Molly, if you would like to.
Before we do that, Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually do have a little issue with the fiscal note. They're making a lot of assumptions that I've been told in various committees that we don't make. It's called dynamic scoring instead of static scoring, so it just depends on what the departments end up wanting the bill to, or the fiscal note to look like. But my question, maybe Senator Wolf or maybe Ms. Olson could fill me in. When the non-custodial or whatever the word is, I'm not really sure that when the parent who doesn't have physical custody of the child is got the child in their care, would you say that their financial burden, take the child support, let's say child support doesn't change, but would their financial burden, if that's what we want to all talk about here is money, would that go up, do you think? What happens when the non-custodial parent has got that child? Does the cost go down for the custodial parent? Do you have any data to help me with that?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Olson, can you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Molly Olson. I live in Little Canada, Minnesota. I'm the founder and volunteer executive director of the Center for Parental Responsibility, an all-volunteer grassroots group mobilizing people interested, citizens interested in this cause. And to answer your question, yes, when the assumption under child support is that the custodial parent or the person that has the most time has the greater financial burden. But when that time is more equalized, then the burden of the financial aspect of raising those kids equalizes more in both households. So yes, if your time goes up with when the children are in your care, your expenses go up.
Hand. Senator Hand.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Very interested and supportive of the concept of allowing both parents to have the presumption that they have quality and that they have the ability to parent their child in that exposure. That I don't have an issue with that. But what I've said to the advocates of this from my own community, and I continue to say, is that the issue is not for me. I think this fiscal note's important, but primarily I'm concerned that for the child, that there be at least one base that is fully funded and operational at an adequate level for the child, and that if you start redistributing resources on the basis of the time the child is spending in each other's home and their costs, now you start to take care of the parents' expenses and abandon what I think has to be the essential concern about finances, which is having at least one solidly economically supported base. If that's established in terms of how money is distributed between the parents and they still have 50-50 shared parenting time, I don't have any difficulty with that. But I am afraid that when we start doing this, we, especially in the case where one of the a typically primary parent doesn't have adequate resources to maintain a reasonable household for children without adequate support from the other parent, that we now have either we really weight it in one place, or we have two inadequate households supporting children. That's my concern. I think this creates that. This language about redistribution of dollars creates that problem for me. And it makes it troublesome for me to support this when, in fact, I support conceptually what you're trying to accomplish here.
Can I ask a question, Senator Wolf? You've got an amendment or the bill as we have it. In the first section, it makes a change to 35% would be the rebuttable presumption of parenting time. And the cost, at least as we're talking about, is in Section 2 that has some bearing, according to the fiscal note, on the MFIP. If we just struck Section 2 and didn't try to get into the issue of trying to divide up the parenting expenses, which I frankly am not sure that this committee really ought to be trying to figure out. That certainly would relieve the obligation for our committee to hold up the bill. Maybe this is something that needs to be sorted out someplace else, but I think the concern I have is that these adjustments in the expense allotments encompass more than just whatever effect it may have on MFIP. There are other issues involved, and I'm just not sure that we're going to be prepared to resolve that here in this committee.
Mr. Chair, the true intent of this bill is to increase parenting time, and I'm torn here because the intent is to increase parenting time. And Senator Sharon, while what you say is very valid, and I'm glad you agree with the concept that both parents are very vital to that child's upbringing, a concern I have to some degree with even the way the system works now is, yes, I think the child should have a stable base, but I think the child should have two stable bases. If making one base so stable creates the other base to become so unstable, that's not healthy for the child either. If one parent loses their home supporting the other home, that's not a good situation for that child either. So I don't support that comment of yours fully because I've seen where when we make one home for the child very strong, it can make the other home very weak, to where one parent might have to, I've heard numerous foreclosures in home because they can't support two households, or living in the basement of a parent, and so that's not good for the child either. Having one home base that's very stable and very financially good to go, and then when they go to the other parent, they have the complete opposite, where there is no stability and that base isn't financially good to go. So I worry about that. If we put too much emphasis on one, that it hurts the other, and it's still affecting the child.
Mr. Chair, may I add something?
Ms. Olson.
In reference to your question, Senator Sharon, one thing that's really important to know is that child support magistrates and district court judges really have full discretion under the current statute to ensure that the expenses are met in the homes. They can adjust. They can override the child support statute when they feel it's necessary to provide the things that you're suggesting.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I am concerned about the process and so on. I was on judiciary. I was here for every minute of the hearing the other night, and we did not spend time on the fiscal note. And when you look at the explosion of costs in 2015, that's because the application date, you can't go in for a new order under this change until that year. And I just remember when Senator Neville had 3, 4, 5, 6 years he spent working on these details. And I know it's contentious. I wouldn't want to have anything to do with family law court. But why he chose to go there is another. But it was a very slow, painful process, and both sides are fighting over it all. I mean, the fact that there is a fiscal note on MFIP going up suggests that Senator Sharon's point is a valid one, that there are more people going to be getting public assistance because they're going to have a cut in their payments. And one of the issues that I remember vividly from 5, 6, 7 years ago when the new system was put in place in Senator Neville's bill was the decision to separate out the child support payments from the parenting time. So the parents could discuss what's appropriate parenting time, and the courts could consider what's appropriate time and how to balance all those difficult things without having a parent come in there with any financial incentive to try and get more time. And So I guess I'm just concerned we're on the last day of the deadline, and we're first time discussing the impact on welfare, impact on the courts. And I guess I sat in for the whole 2 hours or 2.5 hours the other night, and it was a good discussion. I thought it was a very valid discussion, but just doing that and the research, I mean, I don't know what the average parenting time decision the courts give is. I don't know what it is. It has to be, the presumption is 25% now. I don't think 25% is what's always given. I think there's a whole range of things, and a lot of parents are choosing through parenting, shared parenting agreements and so on, are trying to do equal things or greater amounts. And I think that's all good. I just am very concerned that the last day of deadline, we're putting through something that takes a very carefully balanced, and I know neither side feels it's good balance. I mean, both sides have their objections to it. But I'm very concerned we're just kind of pushing something through here at the legislature that's going to change the whole dynamic of the courts, and the fiscal notes suggest that that is going to happen, both for the court impact and also the welfare impact. And the fact that MFIP costs are going up does imply some parents who are very low income are going to be losing money, and we're going to be increasing welfare payments to deal with it. So I'm not sure today's the day we should be dealing with this.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of moving the bill forward, and I hear you know, many stating that they agree with the concept of having both parents spending more time with their children, just wondering how the committee would feel if at the possibility of if we're going to reduce Section 2, potentially raising the percent even up to 40% and then not mess with the child support.
So are you, Senator Wolf, suggesting that we strike Section 2, which would deal with at least the fiscal note problem from our perspective, and then changing the line 2.10 to be 40 rather than 35? Is that your thought?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sharon.
I would just suggest that those be two separate motions so that the committee, I think the committee might view each of those a little bit differently.
All right. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I'd object to those being two separate motions.
Okay. Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, you know, I had a line of questioning a little while ago about the schedule of how things happen, and I've heard, you know, of at least a couple of times the reference to this having been a compromise agreement, and actually somebody did bring me some of the paperwork from Judiciary the other night, and I see that the delete everything that was adopted was drafted back on the 8th of March, and to my knowledge, nobody from, none of the people who are interested in it from the other side were aware of it until the Judiciary Committee, and the fiscal note from the Judiciary, from the court's side, was prepared on March 13th and was available, presumably, to the author who was working this amendment. So, I mean, when we call it a compromise, I mean, I'd like to know, Senator Wolf, did you work with the people who opposed the original bill? I mean, it does appear to me, when I look a little deeper into the timelines, that there was several days to work on this and to have these conversations, and pushing them through at the last minute in committees on a very, very contentious issue like this that does have a core of really valuable discussion that needs to be happened. But, it, you know, when we talk about compromise, to me it means something more than sitting at the table and you know, introducing something that you've been thinking about for a long time without engaging the other side. And that's what appears to me as I dig a little farther from, you know, and again, I'm just getting into this for the first time. I read what I had before me. I started a line of questioning, and people brought me the amendments and what was available in Judiciary, and it is the court's fiscal note that we have before us today that was prepared on the 13th. I mean, I have it right here in front of me.
Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, first of all, I wanted to address a couple of those things. you're right in that we shouldn't use the word compromise, because in order for there to be a compromise, I would have had to have heard from the opposition. I am not in a habit when I have a bill of hunting down opposition. This bill has been around for a long time, and if there were people opposed to it, I would have expected them to make an attempt to meet with me. I did not meet anyone who was in opposition until Wednesday night. And so I can't speak to the other side if the other side doesn't make themselves known. And so I have no way of having that conversation. Like I said, I'm not going to hunt them down. I have heard, obviously, lots from the one side. As far as the fiscal notes, you know, the one you're referring to, I don't know if it was from the original bill. Like I said, this is the fourth fiscal note I've seen. And this one is dated today. So if there were issues, I believe that's all public information that I would have gladly shared had anybody come to speak to me about it. Ms. Olson has come to speak to me. Several other groups have come to speak to me. No one has physically that has opposed this has come to speak to me. And so I agree. I would not call it a compromise. I would call it a really wanting to see something happen. And maybe the original bill was more than people were willing to bite off this year. And so it wasn't a compromise. It was a reduction in request, basically, and with the hope that it will continue to generate a lot of good discussion and continue us moving in that direction. I can't answer you as far as the opposition.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to give some history to the committee. I was originally the chief author on this bill. I became aware of this bill when I entered the legislature last year. And I want to reiterate what Senator Wolf just said. I was the chief author of this all last year, and up until a short time ago I was, and not one opponent of this bill ever tried to get a hold of me, although Ms. Olson brought me into meetings with some of the opponents, and they did try to work on some of these issues. I was there. I witnessed it. So to say that this is a compromise, I would agree with Senator Wolf. This is more of a this has given up almost the whole bill. So if Senator Wolf would like me to, I will move that we amend line 2.10, strike 35, put in 40, and then remove section 2. I will move that amendment.
Well, Senator Hoffman, on your motion, it's been requested that the committee separate those two questions and have a separate vote on each one. And if you're agreeable to that, we can certainly proceed with that. And so are you making a – do you want to divide that motion into two parts? And
no, Mr. Chair, I actually oppose dividing them.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think that, in fairness, there is somebody that would like to speak to the bill on the agenda here. Maybe it's coming time to hear from them before we –
Well, and I
move amendments that
sure,
that
and
get
I
get to
I,
the very core of the bill.
I do have someone on the list of Linda Hugdahl. I am trying to avoid having this become the Judiciary Committee and talk about the policy, and it may be impossible to do that.
Would support you, Mr. Chair, in trying to focus on the MFIP, but then also in trying, in an honest attempt to try to figure out what's been going on with this, which are legitimate lines of questioning.
Right.
I think this is a very sensitive and a very important issue that we discuss. And so I'm not, I don't intend to just try to kill it. But this is problematic, what I see before me. So if we could.
All right. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Services. And I'm actually going to jump to the issue about the potential amendment piece first, just because it's the latest of discussion. But the judiciary, I wasn't going to talk about that so much, because my understanding is that was more kind of the province of the judiciary, the 35% number, and whether it should be 35 or a different number. That was debated somewhat within the judiciary. It sounds like it may be being changed here. That's a piece. That's a significant change to the law to raise that presumption. Our concern would just be to make sure we understand why we're doing that. And this is a really very really real impact to families out there. And if we're going to be making a significant change like that, that we be able to have a discussion about. To be honest, I'm here, obviously. I just heard that. I haven't had a chance to talk with any of our practitioners about what they think. So that being said, Mr. Chair, would you like me to kind of just get to the testimony about the bill as it sits before the committee?
Well, I'm reluctant to have this become a debate about the judicial impact of shared parenting and that whole issue, which I do remember. I was on the Judiciary Committee when Senator Neville was wrestling with this. And we've got a number of bills, and we've got about an hour and a half to get through them. So I'm hesitant to turn this into a broad discussion about that policy, which I think is beyond the jurisdiction of the committee. What I really am trying to focus on, I'll be quite candid with you and the committee, is that we've got a cost here that is affecting potentially our budget. I'm trying to find a way to not have that cost and either get it back to Judiciary where they can deal with the other issues and move it there so that we don't have to try to figure out what those judicial issues are. And that's why I suggested that if we take Section 2 out, and if you want to change the percentage of time without changing the calculation of cost, that may not have any impact on our budget, but it may have some significant issues in the Judiciary Committee, which I'm happy to send it back to if they want to wrestle with it there. But I am a little bit concerned about going on for another hour or so on this issue. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, since we seem to have an expert, could you please tell us, with regard to the change in Section 2, I'm sorry, in Section 1, line 2.10, we are looking at modifying that to 40. Mm-hmm. What was the original draft of this legislation? What was that number in the original draft last year?
Senator Wolf, Ms. Hogdahl?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, the underlying bill before the delete all is your question, I believe?
No.
Just make sure I'm answering
Mr.
my question.
Mr. Chair, this bill was drafted in the House, and I believe Senator Hoffman picked it up here in the Senate last year. There was a percentage of parenting time in that original draft. This has undergone several modifications. What was the original number?
Correct. Senator Benson, the original bill that Senator Hoffman was the author on originally and was being discussed in the House, that number was set the presumption at 45.1%, which also ties to a child support impact.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Benson.
So we see there has already been a significant drop from the original position on this bill. And so if we're going to delete Section 2, I think in the interest of compromise, we could step back to the closer to the original position. And if Judiciary would like to take another look at it, but I am not willing to cede everything on this bill.
Mr. Chair.
It's been a 13-year fight to get here.
Senator Hayden, we have an amendment on...
Right. So following kind of your thought process, it would not be appropriate for us to change, or at least in my opinion, to get into issues that really should be changed and talked about in the Judiciary Committee. Your thought process, if I'm following, and please, you know, tell me if I didn't see it the way you see it, Mr. Chair, was you really wanted to talk about the impact that it had on our budget and the budget that we have responsibility over, which is the impact that it has on the Minnesota Family Investment Program. And so if we are to make any modifications to the bill, it would seem to be proper to me to make the deletion of Section 2. And then if we want to send this back to Judiciary or wherever it goes from here to wrestle again over the section or the subsection E, that's another committee's prerogative, and that's where the experts lie in which to wrestle that question.
We do have a motion. Senator Hoffman has offered the amendment to the bill to strike Section 2 and to change the number on 2.10 to be 45 rather than 35.
To divide, Mr. Chair.
Senator Marty moves to divide the motion.
Yes, to divide.
And I believe the author of the motion gets to choose which part to deal with first. Is that your understanding, Senator Marty?
Yeah.
And was it 40 or 45, Senator Hoffman?
40, Senator Hand.
40. Sorry. So motion has been, your motion has been amended to divide it. Which part would you prefer to take up first?
We can take up section 2, striking section 2
first. All right. On the motion to strike section 2, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. On the motion to change line 2.10 from 35 to 40, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Division has been called for. All in favor of the change, signify by raising your right hand. And those opposed? Motion carries. Senator Wolf, your bill has been adjusted. I don't know if it's been requested to go anywhere else. I would imagine you might want to take it back to judiciary at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just want to clarify. I'm assuming at this point I have no reason to go to Finance Committee, but would need to take it back to judiciary potentially if the chair of judiciary would like to hear it. Or how does that work?
Well, we've not gotten any requests, but
Mr. Chair.
There's some question about whether we've completely dealt with the judiciary fiscal part of this. I suppose one thing we could do is we could forward it to finance and let the judiciary committee claim it back or send it on. I've not got a request. But based on what Mr. Albrecht is suggesting, I think at the very least we ought to send it to finance committee. But if you think that these are things that need to be discussed again in judiciary, I'm happy to have that be where it goes. And I know we have members on the Judiciary Committee here, so I'm open to a suggestion.
Mr. Chair, I will yield to the wisdom of the chair.
All right. Senator Hoffman, would you like to move that the bill be passed and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee?
Senator Hahn, I move that Senate file, is it 1402, be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to Judiciary.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Next, Senator Rosen, Senate File 2188.
Why in the world did we get two? There's two of them.
Senator Rosen, Senate
Thank
file.
You, Mr. Chair.
2188.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have a delete all amendment, the A3 amendment for Senate File 2188.
Just received that, and we'll give the members a moment to get a copy of it. And you have a copy of the amendment as well?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Did you want to offer that as an author's
amendment? I do. I move the A3 amendment, please.
Senator Rosen offers as an author's amendment the A3 amendment to Senate File 2188. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The amendment basically lines us up with what's happening in the House, but it's a little bit of a departure from the original bill, but it brings it back to the same intent. Basically, in 2010, we authorized the implementation of a two-chemical dependency pilot project. That was my bill back in 2010. The projects were created in Washington County and Region 10 counties of southeast Minnesota, which are Dodge, Fillmore, Goodhue, Houston, Maurer, Olmsted, Steele, Wabasha, Waseca, and Winona. And we also have a handout, Mr. Chair and members, talking about some of the key indicators that you also have. The legislation that we have now would allow the counties to use the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund dollars for prevention and treatment strategies supported by evidence-based practices and allows the counties to utilize their 22.95% chemical dependency share more flexible than currently prescribed by the CCDTF. And it will also allow the counties to opt into a chemical dependency pilot framework similar to the 2010 framework, which is currently being used again by Washington and the 10 counties in southeast Minnesota. This is, again, strictly optional for the counties. They are committed to providing a more effective, comprehensive treatment, which in a number of instances includes procuring stable housing, which is one of the first steps in creating a stable environment for the client that leads to successful treatment and being held accountable for those results. We also, back in 2010, made them look at peer support, family engagement support, again, housing support, rent subsidy, supported employment, and independent living skills. This is definitely not an effort to get more money. Instead, it's orientated towards providing counties more flexibility in spending available resources to get better results. And I think, Mr. Chair and members, that's exactly what we want the counties to be able to do, to use their dollars more efficiently. It's also an effort to reduce the spillover in terms of expenses to counties' correction system and the public safety at large. The outcomes from the two-year project were very, very positive, as you can see. And with me, Mr. Chair, we have Mr. Jim Behrens, the Director of Adult and Family Services from Olmsted County, who will also like to discuss some of the outcomes that we had.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Behrens. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Jim Behrens. I work for the Olmsted County Community Services as Adult Division Director. I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair and committee members, to talk with you briefly about the outcomes we've had in our pilot projects over the past, well, for the first full year of the pilot. I'm here representing Minnesota Intercounty Association, the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. As already is mentioned, Olmsted County is part of a 10-county collaborative in rural southeast Minnesota that was chosen to participate in a chemical health pilot a couple of years ago. Washington County is also participating in that pilot. Even though we're considered two separate pilots, we completed the planning and implementation process together, so they look very similar, and we did this in partnership with the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division from the Department of Human Services. I'm here today presenting some preliminary outcomes from both pilots. We implemented the pilots in late 2010, so we are able to provide some early outcome indications from the county perspective. What we know about the individuals being served in the pilot is that they have limited life skills and have limited social support systems. We also know that a majority are also involved in the criminal justice system and that a majority have a co-occurring diagnosis of mental health problems in addition to numerous other physical health problems. Finally, we know that all the individuals involved in the pilot have been through chemical health treatment, chemical dependency treatment, at least two times in their lifetime. This does not suggest that our treatment system is not effective. It indicates that for some individuals, additional, more intensive support is needed in order for them to be better equipped to cope when they are discharged back into their home communities. We believe that our outcomes are beginning to show that when given the added support that the navigators in our pilots provide to help participants find stable housing, obtain employment support, and to begin to develop support networks, individuals with chronic chemical health challenges do become more successful at moving along their personal path to recovery in a community setting. As the charts that you have indicate, during the first full year of the pilot, 85 individuals received navigator services. Prior to that participation, they averaged collectively 129 admissions to detox annually. During the first year of navigator services, these same clients had 64 detox admissions. Also, prior to navigator services, 95% of the clients in the pilot were unemployed, and at the end of the first year, 65% had either obtained a job or were receiving employment support of some sort. Finally, prior to navigator services, 56% were homeless, and after the first year, 98% of those individuals have found housing. For the individuals that have been identified, we believe the pilot is a good beginning and a good investment in using public resources wisely. We also believe that without the navigator, the majority of those individuals would not have been able to achieve the early successes that I've mentioned. The counties involved with the CD pilots will continue to work with the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division of the Department of Human Services over the next year to look more closely at the information that is being gathered related to outcomes for this pilot. But at this point, we are confident the outcomes will continue to be positive. I'm very aware of the importance of objective, thorough evaluation, especially when there are pilot projects that are looking at using alternatives to what is considered traditional treatment. But I have to say, I've heard the stories of many of the individuals that we serve. Many have, for the first time in many, many years, are getting primary care medical services in primary care clinics. Many have gone back to school and increased their education status and are looking forward to a better life because of increased education. Almost all are resolving their criminal justice issues, and almost all are renewing family connections that have been estranged for many years and sometimes even decades. And finally, many are returning back to treatment in order to again begin to work on providing a better future for themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Behrens. Are there questions for the witness? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then if there's no further questions and this was a compromise A3 amendment, I would move that Senate File 2188 be recommended pass and sent straight to the floor, please.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Behrens. Do we want to, Senator Rosen, are you willing to take up 2262 as well?
That'd be okay, Mr. Chair. That'd be great.
2262.
And I promise this is good.
All right.
This is good. Mr. Chair, as you know, there has been a lot of talk on this bill, and a lot of compromise has been going on, and I want to personally again thank Senator Lori for being a part of this compromise and this work. So Senate File 2262, again, members, makes the needed changes to the provider peer grouping program that was adopted in 2008 when we did the bipartisan plan or support on the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Reform Act. So, and thank you to you too, Mr. Chair, for your leadership on this and your the necessary time to get this done. So there is an agreement by the health plans, the providers, and the hospitals. And so with that, I would like to move the A7 amendment, please.
Senator Rosen moves the A7 amendment to Senate File 2262. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could mention just what the A7 amendment does, there is no language in this A7 amendment on the expansion of the PPG at all. It takes out the controversial language in the encounter data, which is on this amendment, line 1.9 through line 1.7. That's, I believe, subdivision 4, if it's still the same in this bill.
It's in subdivision 4.
Section 4, subdivision 4. That's correct. And then it also makes this bill cost neutral, which in the amendment is line 1.21 to 1.22. With that, Mr. Chair, I do have a comment I'd like to read about this amendment.
Sure.
I'm offering the amendment which corrects the problems associated with the provider peer grouping statutes, which were part of the 2008 health care reforms. This amendment represents a negotiated agreement from a multiple stakeholders, including the Minnesota Medical Association, the Minnesota Hospital Association, and the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. This amendment addresses the problems with the provider peer grouping process by giving providers an opportunity to review and verify their data before it is published. The bill only addresses the problems with the PPG process. It does not expand the use or the data collected for PPG. Mm-hmm. I want to be clear about another point. It is the intent of this agreed upon language that no provider pricing information is shared between providers. This language requires the commissioner to only use the data to carry out the responsibilities of PPG, including supplying data to providers that is specific only to that provider. This will allow providers to be able to verify their results of the PPG process consistent with the corrections included in this bill. So, members, I urge your support of the amendment in this bill, and I want to again thank everybody in this room that has been a part to make this compromise. I'm sure going forward they'll continue to work on making necessary changes, but right now this is pretty good.
All right. Thank you, Senator Rosen, and I appreciate all the work that you and others, I know Senator Lurie as well, have had on this issue, and appreciate your willingness to get something worked out that we can move forward with. Senator Lurie?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to concur that this is a good bill, and it was the result of a great deal of work by the members that you mentioned and by the departments, Health and Human Services were both at the table and working on this, and we took care of the fiscal note. I can't avoid just saying it was a better bill, but we will continue to talk about this as we move forward, and this is a really good bill, and it is a good compromise, and I think this will solve the PPG issues and give everybody a great deal of comfort as we move forward, and I want to applaud Senator Rosen for all of her leadership in this. It's really important.
All right. Thank you, Senator Lurie. Are there other questions on this bill? And I don't know if there's anybody in the audience that wanted to make a comment, but I'm not seeing anybody rushing to the table. So,
and Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 2262 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor, please.
All right. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
We do have a bill by Senator Nienau. I don't know if he is here. The last two on the agenda are my bills. However, I am going to postpone Senate File 2530, take it off of today's agenda. So we only have two bills. Maybe what we could do is... you know where Senator... Why don't we... I'm going to ask for about a five-minute recess so we track down Senator Nino to see if he's willing to come back and present the bill. If he's not, we'll take up 2463. So we are in recess for about 5 minutes. Senate File 1811, Senator Nienau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the committee's efforts to let me get here. I'm working between two committees at the same time today, as many of us are. The Senate File 1811 has to do with advanced diagnostic imaging. but before I get into the bill, Mr. Chair, if I may offer an author's amendment just orally. It's fairly simple changes, but if I could do that and then describe the bill.
Let me get the bill here.
Would you like me to explain what I want to do, Mr. Chair?
Sure. Go ahead.
On line 1.9, strike the words computed tomography. On line 1.2, strike everything after commission through the semicolon.
I'm sorry, line...
1.20, sorry.
1.20, everything after commission?
Through the semicolon.
Okay.
And through what? Before the word
the
joint, add the word the.
And add the word the on line 1.20 before the word joint.
That
so it would read the joint commission semicolon.
Yes.
Okay.
And reason for that change, Mr. Chair, is that the name is not as printed. It's been changed.
All right. Why don't we just go ahead and take up that oral amendment as an author's amendment at this point. And Senator Nienau moves the oral amendment to remove on lines 1.9, computed tomography, and on 1.20, adding the word the prior to the word joint, and then striking the words after commission through the semicolon. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Senator Nienau.
Mr. Chair, this bill, so far, has had no opposition and very non-controversial. It simply would require accreditation for those entities that are doing this kind of advanced imaging. The intent of the bill, which my understanding is everyone in Minnesota who does this now would be in compliance with this law if it were put into effect today. So this is not putting any additional requirement on anyone that is doing this business, but it's intended to look out to the future to prevent, for lack of a better term, certain shysters from coming in and providing low-quality service. And I'll let some others testify to that, Mr. Chair. I do know there's some people that want to speak to this, and maybe we could let them get into more detail if you would so like.
Senator, are there people here to testify?
Oh, maybe not. I was told they wanted to come and talk. If not, then I will get into that a little bit more, Mr. Chair.
Well, let me just make anyone here wishing to testify on Senate File 1811. Seeing anybody rushing to the table.
Sorry, I just had some conversations, Mr. Chair, with some people who suggested they might want to talk about it, but I can do that. There have been concerns in mostly other states where, kind of figuratively speaking, people or organizations will load up some of this technology into the back of trucks, so to speak, and provide these services not being accredited. And the results are often not usable, ultimately resulting in higher cost of care because they have to do an additional imaging procedure in order for those that view or use these images for medical services. So the intent is just to prevent that from occurring here. Other states have been taking similar actions. The concern is that might squeeze some of that activity this direction. That is what the intent of the bill is. There has been no opposition. There was no testimony in opposition in the other body. They heard this bill and sent it up to the floor already. There is a fiscal note from the companion bill. There is no fiscal impact.
Right. Members, you do have a copy of a fiscal note that is actually written to the House file, but it is essentially the same bill, and it does not show any cost associated with this proposal. Questions? Seeing none.
Well, Mr. Chair, there has been absolutely no opposition to this bill at all. If the committee would be willing, we could send it up to the consent calendar.
To move it to the consent calendar, I have no opposition to that. Not seeing any opposition, we'd be happy to do that. So do you want to make that motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 1811 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the consent calendar on the Senate floor.
Senator Enow moves Senate File 1811 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor as part of the consent calendar. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Enow, if you would like to come and take the gavel, I want to bring up the last bill on our agenda, 2463.
What bill do we have? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill that has to do with the screening issue that has been had a little bit of a controversy attached to it recently. There was a lawsuit and a subsequent judgment by the court that has prompted the need to change some of the language we have in the statute with respect to the policy surrounding newborn screening. This bill was introduced. Day or two before. My understanding is that the Judiciary Committee has requested to see this as well, so we'll have to move it to the Judiciary Committee. Assuming we move it, there's also an amendment that Council has prepared. Senator Higgins asked today. I understand that they went through and found some language and other changes that are more nature and perhaps. Explain the A2 amendment.
Senator Hand is offering the A2 amendment. Is that correct, Senator Hand?
Chair, that's correct. And ask Ms. Kavanaugh can maybe just talk a little bit. I don't believe there's anything.
Senator Hand, your microphone is situated poorly. We can't
hear. So you can't hear. Can you hear now?
That's wonderful.
Better?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, the A2 is simply technical cleanup language. There is no substantive changes to the language.
Right.
It's just technical.
Seeing no questions, Senator Hand has offered the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. The amendment is adopted.
As I said, Mr. Chair, this is a bill that is being proposed due to the fact that there were some changes necessitated by a recent court decision and with respect to how the newborn screening is conducted, more specifically with the question of retention of the genetic material and how that is to be used or handled going forward. I would like to invite perhaps some testimony from the department, maybe briefly to walk through the bill, and I understand there may be some others that wish to testify as well.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hello, my name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health. I guess I would start by, if you would like, I'd go through the sections of the bill and then give a brief statement as to our interest in it.
Certainly.
Section 1 of the bill instructs the Minnesota Department of Health to make materials available to parents and or guardians. Section 2 are the parental options. When they are, after a child is born and before screen occurs. The Section 3 defines newborn screening program operations, what that is and is not. Section 4 is allows for the use of blood spots for program operations during a retention period. Section 5 defines a standard retention period for 71 days and 24 months for data, 71 days for the blood spots. Section 6 is the written and informed consent for other use of samples and test results. Section 7 is the ability to revoke consent for storage and use. In Section 8, the commissioner duties are defined. These are just a brief overview. I will be happy to go into more detail on any section, but I would like to just give a brief background. And I first like to thank Senator Hand for introducing the bill and a number of conversations that we've had leading up to this point, and appreciate the time he's given and the courtesy of introducing the bill for this discussion. This legislation makes a lot of changes to the bills, but they're very important changes. And as Senator Hand said, this is all predicated on a Supreme Court decision last fall, the Bearder decision, and what we have brought forward are what we hope to be an open discussion of what we'd like to do moving forward, and we want it to be as transparent to the legislature as well as to the public. Most of you are familiar with newborn screening. In fact, Minnesota in 1965 became the first state to do newborn screening. Started with one screen for PKU, which was a significant breakthrough. What happens is if these screens are not done, these are very rare disorders that without treatment lead to illness, physical disability, mental retardation, and in some cases death. But when they're detected through this newborn screening process, a simple change in diet and or medications and the problems associated with these disorders can be treated. The screening program, for all intents and purposes, has become a standard of care across the nation after its start here in Minnesota. We've gone from one screen in 1965 to 53 disorders today and have also added hearing loss as an additional screening. There are 68,000 newborns each year, approximately, in Minnesota, and all of them, majority of them, receive this screen. And it has led to approximately anywhere from 150 to 180 diagnoses per year. I don't believe anyone in the room denies the importance of these screens, but I also want to quickly add that there's a big difference between the screen for these blood spots that occurs and what happens after the screening is completed to the blood spot and to the data. The Supreme Court agreed with this and came to a very similar place. In their decision last fall, the Supreme Court said a newborn screening statute authorizes the collection of the blood samples to allow the department to conduct the tests expressly authorized by statute. But those same statutes do not expressly authorize the department to conduct any other use, storage, or dissemination of blood samples. So it was clear that the screen itself should continue, but how we treat and store following that screen is what we're here, and I think what this bill is majority of this bill is meant to address. I believe it's critical, though, to impress upon you the need to if we could draw a line between the importance of the screening itself, the miracles that have occurred as a result of these screens, and the addition of each one of these important additions over since 1965 and the impact they've had on families, and ensuring that we can continue to have the best program possible. We have been considered to have one of the best programs in the country. And then the second piece, the bright line, the second piece is the storage and use of this data. The reality has changed, and we want to move forward with a robust consent for this storage and use of data. We understand it. We know that it has to happen, and we want to move forward cooperatively with that program. There is one piece that I think is also very important to stress, and that is the portion of the bill which talks about the retention period. Following a screen, when a baby is born, the first 24 to 48 hours of newborn screening occurs, and then there is a retention. This is called the retention period. So the blood spot is retained for 71 days. This was a motion we filed with the court following the Supreme Court decision. This was the length of time that we felt necessary for a conclusive testing of these spots. At the end of 71 days, those spots are destroyed unless a parent would give consent for those to be kept longer. During that retention period, we in this legislation are asking to use those spots for quality assurance. And that quality assurance or program operations is a very important part of the newborn screening process in order to validate that all of our equipment is working. If we introduce new chemicals, each time we bring in new reagents, we need to test the equipment, make sure it's testing correctly. Right now, we are prohibited from doing that because the Supreme Court only allows us to conduct the screen itself. So there is that piece, and I think that's another important part. So if I were, and not to oversimplify, but if I were to say that the two most important pieces of this legislation is really to allow for program operations to occur, and then the second piece is to have the clear discussion and outcome that we have in a consent process for storage and use of data that is informed consent and is clear to all those that are involved in the process.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel. Any questions? Senator Hopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the quality assurance. What have you been doing for the last 4 months since the decision?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, we have not had a quality assurance program.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So why haven't you gone to the court and filed another motion to request that the quality assurance be able to be performed within that 71-day period? Is there a reason why the department hasn't gone and filed a motion to ask for that?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, that wouldn't be – I'm not an attorney, so I'm not going to try to answer that the best I can. My understanding from the Supreme Court decision is that was a clear directive we could continue the screen, and that is that because of there was statutory authority to do so, and it is limited to that. We couldn't file a motion to try to do something that had already been ruled upon. All we were trying to do in the motion that we did file with the retention period that we put to 71 days was to clarify that that was what we were using as our retention period. The court left that open in that regard.
Questions? Senator Hamm?
Well, excuse me, Madam Chair, I know that there may be some other people that want to testify, and I think this language does represent some of the things that were being raised as issues. I know we had a bill in our committee, budget bill last year, that was addressing this issue, but it does provide for informed consent to continue to use those samples for any kind of research or testing. The 71-day retention period, there may be some debate about that, but the way the law is written or the bill is written, that the samples would be disposed of concluding that period of time. Just for members' reference, Section 3 of the bill does define what quality assurance and improvement means, and it says it does not include research or the development of new tests. So I think what the department is trying to accomplish here is, first of all, to comply with the requirements of the court decision. The thing that is a little bit of a disappointment to me, Madam Chair, to be quite candid, is that this is an issue that's been around for a few years. I think it warrants some good discussion, debate, thinking about it. We're here at the very last day. That we could possibly, well, we are going to have to get a dispensation from the Rules Committee, I think, to move it forward. But I wish we could have had a little more time to bring this through committees and get some additional testimony with respect to it. But I believe there are some other folks that want to comment on the bill and would certainly like to hear that.
Thank you, Senator Hamm. We have been working on this a long time. Senator Sharon.
Just a quick question for our testifier. The newborn screening program operations, which is the quality assurance component of the that's important in this legislation, according to your testimony, could you highlight, just you don't have to go on for a lifetime, but what the absence of this provision would mean in terms of newborn screening?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, the program operations is valuable in a number of ways. If what we have not been able to do is bring new machines online, or if a machine breaks down, we aren't able to use the backup machine. We have to wait till the new till the machine is repaired. It becomes very difficult day in and day out to make sure that the quality of our testing and the accuracy of our testing is right. So what we generally do is, this is a fairly simple process of a punch in a blood spot that you conduct a screen on a newborn baby. The test is conducted and completed on a piece of equipment. The next day we may run another punch from that same spot to get the same result. And what that shows is that we have the machine operating and reading correctly. There are approximately 8,000 of these punches that we use a year for quality assurance. If we don't do that here, we will have to begin buying those from another state. The cost is approximately $10 per punched spot, or about $80,000. But one of the things that we lose when we do that is our population. One of the things about being able to do quality assurance as an example of a particular group where we were getting false positives on Hmong babies because they had a particular chemical in their blood which was higher than average in newborns, just a cultural norm, but not norm for our testing. We were able to, through our retesting and through this quality assurance, go back and adjust the tests to eliminate those false positives. And that's the type of thing that the quality assurance program allows. And finally, we are adding a new test this year, a 54th newborn screen for severe combined immunodeficiency, or the boy in the bubble that may be more familiar to many of you. And we will not be able to bring that machine online till we're able to do quality assurance with it, and knowing that we'll get those same results.
Senator Sharon.
So if I were to synthesize that, you test your own equipment to be certain that it's consistent and valid information, and it also creates for you some confirmation or validity to the original screen.
Mr. Couple.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, that's much better than I did, yes.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I hear correctly that you haven't been doing quality assurance since the Supreme Court decision?
Mr. Cobble.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, that is correct.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, that's chemistry 101, analytical chemistry 101. You calibrate your machines every day. Are you really telling us you don't calibrate when you're doing these tests right now?
Mr. Gobble.
I'm looking back at Madam Chair and Senator Benson. I may need some help with that question and to give you a more technical answer.
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, and maybe Mr. Gobble or someone else from the department, but in one of the meetings that I had, it was suggested that the state was procuring sample material from other states to be used for this purpose, and I may have misunderstood that, but that was my understanding, is that they were using blood spots from other places, that there was some cost to associate with that. I'm not sure what it was, but that's my understanding.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi. My name is Dr. Joanne Bartkus. I'm the director of the Public Health Laboratory at the Minnesota Department of Health, and what I'd like to clarify is that we are doing calibration. We are doing some measure of quality assurance, but not the complete panel. The samples that we use for calibration, and that's a very specific term. Those are actually standardized spiked samples that we get from the Centers for Disease Control. So they do have a quality assurance program, and some materials are available to us, but it's not the full complement. So, for example, for the SCID testing, the boy in the bubble disease that Jim mentioned earlier, that particular test actually requires absolutely infant blood as the calibrator, because adult blood doesn't have the analyte in it. So we're doing partial quality assurance. I don't want anybody to think that we're just willy-nilly testing babies and keeping our fingers crossed, but it's not optimal, and we can't do other pieces of the quality assurance like setting cutoff values or confirming that new batches of reagents are working the way we hope, because negative samples are better for that.
Thank you, Dr. Marcus. Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, I don't want to cut off any further debate, but I would like to ask counsel if in subdivision 8 on page 4 talks about written informed consent in this bill for use of the samples beyond the newborn screening, which was kind of, I think, one of the central issues in the lawsuit. But I believe there is a statutory reference somewhere that talks about what written informed consent means, maybe in a genetic privacy section. I believe that it would be helpful to find a reference to that and include it in this section of the bill to make sure that the written informed consent is in conformance with that. Is that something, am I asking you to go outside your scope of practice?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Kavanaugh.
Senator Hahn, I'm not familiar with an actual statutory site that defines what informed consent is. It might be that it's just common law and court cases that have defined that, but judiciary is who might have the expertise to answer that.
Okay.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that there is something, and I don't recall, and I'd have to look and try to source it out. But since this bill will go to judiciary, maybe we can defer that till that point. But I believe there is a reference. I just believe that if we're going to talk about something that is defined someplace in statute, it would be good to make that reference. But
okay. I think we'll start with the testifiers. Ms. Brace.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and we've been working on this issue since we discovered it in 2003. And I want to, I know that Senator Hand took this bill on request of the department, and we have some concerns about it, which we have shared with him. I just want to give you a little history from our perspective. So from our perspective, we discovered the fact of this collection back in 2003 when the department came with a bill to say that they could have the ability to increase the number of conditions for which children were tested without ever having to come back to the legislature. And that concerned us because we understood that this was genetic testing, not just newborn screening. But in the process of that discussion, we then discovered the fact that the department was keeping all the genetic test results and all the blood spots and had been doing so for quite some time. And today it's about 24 years for the genetic test and about 14 years for the blood spots. So thus, the DNA of all these children is now on file with the health department, and it's nearly 1 million children. In 2006, some of you may recall that the legislature passed the Minnesota Genetic Privacy Act, which required informed written consent for the collection, storage, use, and dissemination of genetic information. In 2007, an administrative law judge found that the department was violating the statute by doing more than the newborn screening, by doing the storage, use, and dissemination. And so for the next 3 years, the department tried to exempt the newborn screening program from the genetic privacy law. Thankfully, they were unsuccessful. In 2009, 9 families sued the department for the violation of the Genetic Privacy Act as well as for a violation of constitutional rights. And on November 16th, the Supreme Court ruled that for the families, saying that the department indeed had no right to do anything other than the screening of the children, that the law prior to the Genetic Privacy Act did not give them permission, and that the law after the Genetic Privacy Act specifically forbid it. So we have been fighting for 8 years to get family rights, patient rights, privacy rights, DNA property rights secured, and now we have a Supreme Court decision to back that up. But this bill, I feel like this bill has really come with the intent to somewhat undo what the Supreme Court did and what they said. So I'm just going to give you a few of the things in the bill because there actually are quite a lot of things, and Mr. Koppel and I spent about 2 hours together looking at the bill and me sharing our concerns. And one of those concerns has to do with the consent process. And it has always been a concern of ours what has happened with this. We never had consent before except that the genetic privacy law required it, but they were not following it. And so they were willfully violating the law for about 6 years now. But we had an opt-out. And the information that they gave to the opt-out, for parents to opt-out, was all sort of like together and Infamil and all sorts of other kind of things. And so we would have parents contact us 2, 4, 6 months later and say, oh, I found it. And that was supposedly the informed, informing the parents that they had the option to opt out of the screening or opt out of the storage or opt out of the research. But, of course, they hardly ever found it. right? So now when I look at the bill, I see nothing specific that would keep that sort of thing from happening. In my discussions with Mr. Koppel, there were various things that concerned me about how they were looking at the process, separating the signature from the information that the parents needed to know to even give consent. And furthermore, we have remained concerned, as we have always been, about the information that's shared. So there's nothing to require that parents be told that the blood spot is DNA. There's nothing that requires them to talk about it being genetic consent being the primary purpose, or that the law can change, or that the government owns the blood spots, the DNA of their child, if they let the government own it. So one thing I'm going to just pass out here, if I can get a page to come and take this. I don't know where there is one, but I have two things. I have one, the consent form that the department sent to me last night, and the other would be the Tennyson warning from the department for other things. And what I hope you will see in the distinction here is how clear a Tennyson warning is, because it says Tennyson warning at the top. And the Tennyson warning is what's supposed to be given to every person before the government takes their data, so that they know whether or not what data is being taken, whether or not they have to, what the government can do with it. And indeed, the administrative law judge had ruled and said, yes, the government should be offering the Tennyson warning. So you can, once you get that form, you'll be able to see how there are lots of things not detailed in the form regarding what can be done, what kind of information it is, that is DNA, that is the government holding it, that is government property. There's a lot of information. So if we're going to give parents informed consent requirements or put them into law, then we need to be clear that they're actually being informed. And this bill doesn't seem to do it for us. And just so you know, and I know lots of you have probably had children, but I have parents who talk to me about what it's like when they have their baby. Some of the words they say are, we're in a fog. One father told me that his wife forgot what they named their baby. So, you know, this is a difficult time, and if there's any difficulty, if there's anything that doesn't let them know actually what's happening, then they're likely to miss it. They're likely to give consent for something they don't actually realize that's going on, which is why we say they're should be a warning. But just a few additional items above and beyond that. If you go to line 3.30, I'm just going to give four more problems. There are more, but I'm just going to limit it to that. 3.30, where the department wants to keep the child's DNA of anyone who's had a private positive test. Well, as newborn screening has increased the number of conditions for which children are tested, there are more and more false positives. And so, as I think Mr. Koppel may have said, or somebody said, there's like 800 positives, and then there's maybe 150 children that are actually found with a condition. So all of these children would have their DNA owned by the government indefinitely and kept. And so we don't think that just because you have a condition or your child has a condition that you lose the right of consent over the government keeping your DNA. And then for the second thing, number two of the list, the last four things I'm going to tell you, is on line 3.10. Wait a minute here. Oh, yeah. Line 3.10, and I know that there was an amendment to change that wording slightly of the newborn screening program operations, but nonetheless, if you look at line 3.12, you'll see the words such as. And so the list could actually be a lot longer than the list that you see before you. We don't know what all the such as, we don't know how long it could be. We have no idea what could possibly happen under that section. Our third concern is that on line 3.21, because the department says, or actually 3.22, the development of new newborn screening tests, one of our concerns there is that there are old, currently happening, newborn screening tests, but research could take place if they want to tweak or devise or revise or whatever those tests, and that would be research. And then number four, our last concern I'm going to share with you, is lines 4.31 to 3.3. So this is particularly concerning for us, because here what the department would do is open the door to assuming total control over the child's DNA without informed consent. The language could be used to supersede the genetic privacy law. The genetic privacy law says, for the collection, use, dissemination, and storage of genetic information, there must be informed written consent. So if this says the use, collection, use, dissemination, and storage must follow the newborn screening law, then that could potentially supersede the genetic privacy law. And then parents would never have an ability to come back and say, you know, we would have never been able to have the court case that we had. In addition to that, I know from the department that they are expecting or intending to try and change the genetic privacy law to say that all the specimens that are kept are not actually genetic information, and therefore the department would be allowed to keep the blood spots. So these are all concerns of ours, and so we don't believe the department should be keeping the DNA of its children at birth. We believe it's a very vulnerable time for parents, and no matter what you say about consent, that this is not a spot where the government should be. They should be doing the newborn screening, and that should be it. They should not be allowed to collect, approach people at this vulnerable time, maybe have it lost in translation. As far as the parents are concerned, this is the hospital. They don't understand this is the government. They don't understand the reach of the government. And there's nothing in this bill that makes us feel secure or comfortable that the department has backed down from the 8 years that we battled them on this issue. And so we are opposing the bill because we don't believe this is where the department should be. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Any questions? Comments, Mr. Cobble? There was a lot of insinuations there.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd just as soon stick to a discussion on changes to the bill or specific concerns. I would say the some of the issues raised are certainly ones that we want. One of the reasons why we want to have this discussion today, all of these need to be discussed. I think these are valid concerns. I'm relatively new to the department. I've been here about a year. I know these things happened in the past. I know there's a lot of frustration with the department in terms of this, how we have run the program in the past. And so I don't want to pretend that to just jump to today and say we're brand new. But on the other hand, I would like to think that we're coming forward with what I think is a constructive piece of legislation that and the intent is to address those very issues. So in terms of specifics, you know, I think as we get into them and if there are additional questions, I'd be happy to discuss them.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Ms. Brace. Dr. Susan Berry, please. Minnesota Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. She's not here. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today. My name is Susan Berry. I'm a pediatrician and metabolic disease specialist at the University of Minnesota Pediatric Specialty Clinic. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, but also as a person privileged to participate in the lives of families who've been impacted by newborn screening through the diagnosis of their children. Babies with these conditions look like any other baby. You'd never know there was anything wrong with them. You'd never know they have a life-threatening condition. And newborn screening saves babies' lives. I see that every day when I go to work. It's a joy to have the opportunity to make a difference there. The babies with metabolic conditions that have been detected and treated early can grow and thrive. I've also comforted families whose babies died due to a suspected or confirmed condition. Anything we can do that would prevent that, we should. That means new tests, That means doing a better job of screening, making it more accurate, making sure it's done in a quality fashion. Over the past 2 months since the changes necessarily took place after the Supreme Court decision, I've also seen babies whose blood spots have been destroyed in the interim, making it difficult and potentially costly. I'm sure it's costly for the parents to have a confirmed diagnosis. The pediatricians of Minnesota want an effective, cost-efficient, and responsible newborn screening program at the Department of Health. And this bill, while not perfect by any means, you'll hear everyone, no one will be happy, I think, at the end, allows a way for the Department of Health to move forward with its critical work of testing newborns. The department has had one of the top programs in the country in making their work efficient, effective, and with among the lowest false positive rates possible. The Minnesota Academy of Pediatrics very much wants the Department of Health to be able to continue screening newborns and save babies' lives. For that reason, we support the improved process that clearly delineates operation of the newborn screening period program using collected blood spots for newborn testing, calibration, quality assurance, as well as for the development of new tests. We support the automatic retention of blood spots and test results for those infants who have positive test results and are hopeful that this also includes the so-called presumptive positives, the gray zone babies for whom testing is particularly difficult, whether it proves to be true or false positive. Parents and health payers would need to be spared the cost of expensive and agonizing weeks of extra testing that can be improved with the availability of those resources. We support new procedures for parents to consent to the indefinite storage of test samples and results. As a pediatrician, I have seen cases where my colleagues and I have relied on these stored test specimens for further diagnostic purposes that can bring answers to a parent or to a parent who's lost a child. We strongly will oppose any efforts to shorten, We strongly oppose any effort that might occur to shorten that 71-day retention period for blood spots. In fact, I can personally argue that it should be longer. 71 days is long enough for most of the confirmations, but there are specific disorders for which that test period is insufficient for confirmation of diagnosis. So the spots are destroyed before the diagnosis is confirmed. We will also strongly oppose any efforts to change the opt-out nature of the program. Those changes could never be acceptable because doing so would risk the lives of Minnesota's babies, potentially hundreds of newborns each year. I personally never want to visit with another grieving family whose baby could have been saved by a simple test. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, and I'm happy to answer any questions that would be helpful to you.
Thank you, Dr. Berry. Any questions for the doctor? Dr. Berry, I have a question for you. I became a grandmother for the first time yesterday.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
How wonderful.
I know. I'm very excited. However, she was born in Germany. So. Do they have...
In Germany? Germany has a very strong newborn screening program. It's organized in much the same way that ours is. I'm actually fairly familiar with their program. It's a very fine program. It tests essentially the same things we do.
Mm-hmm.
If it's your daughter or your son. Who is the favored parent, if they happen to be in the military also has an extensive newborn screening program as well.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Thank you. You can call me Grammy.
Congratulations. I'm
very excited. I'm all about this baby.
I pray that your grandchild is not subject to these problems.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Berry. And Dr. Mendelson, please, Medical Director of the Medical Genetics of Children's Hospital. I hope I said your name right.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. And as the Madam Chairman said, my name is Nancy Mendelson. I'm a genetics physician at and medical director of genetics at the Children's Hospitals and Clinics in Minnesota. I've worked in the field of genetics for 20 years, and I've witnessed firsthand the life-saving benefits of the Minnesota Newborn Screening Program. We are concerned about the current uncertainty of the program, so we appreciate the department's efforts to clarify how Minnesota will handle storage issues as we move forward. Specifically, we urge you to support the bill's provisions that preserve the storage option, allow the department to maintain the data for 2 years, though we believe it should be longer, and also the parental option to retain blood spots indefinitely. There are important points to clarify, but even with those, we remain extremely concerned about the short 71-day window because it would hinder those of us constantly seeking ways to improve diagnosis and evaluation of diseases and disorders impacting children. To be clear, there are definite benefits to the storage of spots. Once a spot is destroyed, we can never recover that information. Being able to test issues that emerge later in life is critical to ongoing diagnosis. This could impact families that have children with inborn errors of metabolism, sudden infant death syndrome, hearing loss, infections such as cytomegalovirus, and evaluations of siblings. Finally, I can't emphasize strong enough how important it is to maintain the integrity of the newborn screening program. We are already in a precarious position with the current uncertainty, and I believe that any additional efforts to limit or dismantle the screening itself would put children's lives at risk. This is a program focused solely on the goal of saving children's lives and improving their health. Please ensure that it can continue to meet that goal.
Thank you, Dr. Mendelson. Is there any questions for the doctor? Thank you very much. And Ms. Carissa Olson.
Madam and Grammy Chair, thank you for having me here today. My name is Carissa Olson. I am a parent from Brooklyn Park. My husband, Darren, and I have two sons. Our oldest is 6 and our youngest is 3. I'm here to really put a face on newborn screening and how it has impacted our lives. Everett was born on April 14th, 2008. I had a perfect pregnancy. I went to the hospital. Within 3 hours, he was born. I didn't use drugs. In fact, I asked the hospital if I could leave the next day because I had such a great pregnancy and no problems. In the hospital, they asked me about the newborn screen test, and a few months earlier, I had received some information from an organization at my church in the lobby, and so I had filed that negative message in the back of my head. I'm a college-educated person. I read up on a lot of things with pregnancy, and I filed the newborn screen as something negative and wasn't sure about but really didn't have time to investigate. And so coupled with that, I was also delaying vaccines. When the nurse asked if I would take it, I said, I'm not really sure if I need it. I have no known genetic disorders in my family. I had a perfectly healthy first pregnancy. This was great. 3 times she came back into the hospital room. And I finally looked at some of the material, and I realized this is not an invasive test. They're not putting anything into my child's body. They're simply taking a drop of blood. And so I finally agreed. I said, I need to do this test. So we took the test for Everett. Took him home. In fact, I gave my blessing to my husband to leave the next day on a business trip that he needed to take, and everything was fine. The 5th day of his life, I went back to the pediatrician for a routine checkup. All of a sudden, she looked at me, and she said, your son has been tested for a rare metabolic disorder called galactosemia. It is my husband and I both have the same mutated gene on the 9th chromosome, had no idea, and she said, he tested positive for this disorder. You need to stop breastfeeding immediately. We'll put you in contact with some of the great metabolic doctors at the university, and we will do further testing to confirm this rare disorder. I had went home in a daze, didn't know what it meant. I quit breastfeeding because Everett is missing. We found out he's missing liver enzymes to properly break down milk. And if it's not caught at birth, my breast milk was essentially, it could have killed him had we not had that early diagnosis. A few hours later, I went home, and all of a sudden, I couldn't wake him up. He was lethargic. His eyes rolled in the back of his head. I took him to the neonatal intensive care unit at Children's, where Dr. Berry, who just spoke, she was on call. So that newborn blood spot put me in contact with Dr. Berry right away. We were able to get care. He was able to be put on a diet. And now he's very normal in the back. You see him running around there. You come and say hi.
Say hi, Everett.
This is Everett. If Everett would have not been caught at birth, he would have had, 75% infant mortality rate with galactosemia. He most likely would have died, mental retardation, liver failure, cataracts. It is important that we keep this in an opt-out system. If this was an opt-in system in the state of Minnesota, he would have not been tested and he would not be here today possibly. And so I'm really strongly convinced that we need to keep the system as it is, that we... if a parent wants to say, I don't want the test for whatever reason, that's fine. But had the responsibility not been on that hospital to educate me and to gently push me to take that test, I probably wouldn't have taken that. And I'm an educated person, and I well-read, and I didn't think anything of it, didn't think it was necessary. So it's imperative that the system stays to an opt-out system in the state of Minnesota. And I'm thankful to the doctors. I'm thankful to the health department who caught this disorder. Everett's doing great. He's been neurologically tested. He's normal. He's doing fantastic. And it's very sad when I went to the national conference with kids all over the world with his disorder. You could look in the room, and you could see which kids were tested early and which kids were not. It was that different in how they are. He looks pretty normal. So I thank you for your time. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Ms. Olson. And hi, Everett. How old are you?
How old are you?
Yeah. Three? Yeah? You're a big boy. You're cute. Any questions for Ms. Olson or Everett? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Mr. Griffin.
Yes, are you? Simmons wanted to be here today, could not be because she's treating patients. I would just point out that we agree with her assessment and the three points that she made in terms of making this permanently an out test, making sure that we have program operations maintained, this can be done with this, and then talking about maintaining this so that we can keep the new programs coming. We'll be able to test the new program, for new disorders. As Dr. Simmons says in her letter, there are
thank you, Mr. Griffin. Yeah. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I just want the committee to know that I've been called to another meeting that I absolutely am obligated to go to. Senator Hahn, what do you think will be happening here?
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, and yes, we do want to adjourn at noon. And I just was speaking to Senator Limmer. I know that he wants to review this bill. However, this is going to have to go to rules anyway because we missed the policy deadline. I'd like to lay this over. I think there are a couple of things that we should address, and then I need to have some consultation with Senator Limmer about how to get his committee back constituted to have a hearing on the bill. So I would like to lay it over. But before we adjourn, Madam Chair, I also was informed because of that we had earlier re-referred Senator Wolf's bill back to Judiciary. That presents some problems as well. So I'd like to ask if we could reconsider that and refer it to the Finance Committee instead. Give them a chance to deal with the finance issues, and they may have to go back to Judiciary, but I'm a little concerned about just where his committee is in the process, and it may not be sufficient to have a bill sent back to his committee just as we did.
Okay. So, Senator Hahn, you would just like to lay, Senate file 24-623 on the table?
Yes, please.
Okay. All right. And then Senator Wolf's?
I vote on the prevailing side, and I would just like to ask that we reconsider the motion to refer that bill to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, Senator Hahn.
No, Senator Hahn.
I'm sorry.
Finance.
We need to reconsider the motion we already took to send it to judiciary. We need to bring that back, and then we will have a subsequent motion to forward it to finance.
Okay. Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 1402 be reconsidered to move to judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
And then, Madam Chair, I would move that, and I've forgotten, I think it's 2204. Is that the bill number?
1402. Your bill? 1402. Or Senator Wolf's.
1402. 1402, I'm sorry, that be referred to the Finance Committee.
And Senator Hand moves that Senate File 1402 be recommended to be sent to Finance. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Okay. Senator Hand, we are adjourned.
Adjourned until Monday.
Monday.
And I believe we will have an evening session on Monday, so just be aware of that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I didn't hear what you said, Senator Hand. Are we just having a Monday night meeting?
No, we are going to have a meeting on Monday at our normal committee time, but we are likely to have it extend into the evening.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.